are recording.
We are recording. Oh.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, baby.
Hey, baby. So, hey, Freenoters.
This is a weird week.
It's a really weird week.
It's a weird month.
It's a weird month. It's a weird point in our lives. And we took a pause last week.
We did take a pause. We thought a pause was a good thing to take.
I think a pause was appropriate, but the show must go on.
It must.
And, you know, we have a lot of friends who are professional speakers and freenoters, and we've all had a lot of events cancel and postpone, and it's all topsy-turvy.
That's right. So what do you do when you're a speaker but you're not speaking?
I think you get better. I think you take the time to practice your craft. I think you rehearse. I think you work on your stories, which we're going to talk about this week.
Yeah, and I think you work on figuring out how to make your message stand out, because when everybody comes back, there's going to be a lot out there.
There is going to be a lot out there. I think things will come roaring back, but it's really going to be jam-packed in the last third or quarter of the year. And it is, I think, a good time to work on your craft, and I know you and I are taking the time to do that. And hopefully we'll all get back on stages soon.
Let's do that.
So we're going to get back on schedule here, back on track. I think we took an appropriate pause last week. This week we're going to talk about story, and I hope your stories are excellent this week. I hope you're happy, healthy, safe with family.
And cheers to that, Freenoters.
And cheers to that, Freenoters. Let's get on with the show. So this week, we're going to talk about examples.
Yes, examples.
We're going to talk about examples. For example, examples.
Well, what do you mean by examples, Tom?
Well, there's the thing that we want to say. And then there's the way that we explain that thing to people so that they understand what we want to say.
Yeah. One of the ways I often describe that is the difference between the idea and the illustration of the idea.
Yeah. And I think what's really important for people to understand is that not everybody, you know, there's some things that, you know, have been misproven or disproven. Misproven means proven badly. Says the Webster.
But you're a Webster, so you get to invent that term.
So things like left-brained and right-brained, that's disproven. Things like I'm a visual learner or I'm an auditory learner. You have a preference, but you're not incapable of learning in other. Like, that's yep. Disproven. But there are two classes of learners that so far the science has held up here.
Absolutely.
There are rule-based learners and there are example-based learners. And almost to a rhetorician like myself, they're sort of the difference between deductive and inductive reasoners. But we're largely inductive reasoners, which are example-based learners.
Yeah, absolutely. So I first stumbled across this research and this idea in a fantastic book, which I consider to be a must-read if you present information in any way, shape, or form. And it's a book called Make It Stick by Peter C. Brown, I believe. Not to be confused with Made to Stick by Chip and Dan Heath. Also required reading. But in Make It Stick, which is really talking about how people learn and how either you can teach or how you can teach yourself certain things, Peter introduces this concept of rule learners versus example learners. And I think the easiest way for me to explain it is to say that an example learner needs the story and the rule learner needs the moral of that story. Mm. And so for an example learner, for instance, they need a lot of examples of the thing that you're talking about. They need case studies. They need stories. They need ways to make that concrete for them. It's how they understand is saying, where else have I seen this in the world? Show me how that applies. A rule learner naturally pulls the moral of the story out of mm-hmm. whatever that is. Or once the moral has been shown to them, they say, okay, I've got it. And they can, on their own, apply it to other situations. From the research that Peter Brown cites, 3/4 of the population are example learners and 1/4 is a rule learner. And what I take away when I'm as a speaker and as I'm working with other speakers is you cannot only do one because if you only give examples, you are ignoring 1/4 of your audience. And if you only give rules, like here's the point, but here's my like pithy phrase, my phrase that pays, as some people say, you are three quarters of your audience is probably going, well, that's a nice phrase, but I don't see how it applies to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I ran into that years ago in a very frustrating talk I gave. This might have been 8 years ago. I mean, like early on when we had met, I think it was at a now defunct conference called the New Media Expo. And I gave a talk about consumer insights, and I used a couple of examples. I know I used an example about Oldsmobile, about how they went out of business. And at the end of the talk, a woman stood up and she really challenged me, like very combative, I think, that's Oldsmobile is irrelevant to my business. That's a B2C example. What else can you give me? And that was sort of my first real confrontation, because I'm a rule-based learner. I 100% am. And that was, well, can't you figure it out? I gave you that Oldsmobile example. It's the same rule,
right?
But I didn't spell it out. And so, I mean, and she was also a little difficult. So I got to a point where I just said, let's take this offline, which meant never.
Oh.
No. But yeah, I mean, if you are talking, and this is something, you know, we speak at some B2B conferences, you know, marketing profs B2B, and both of us are very, very careful about stocking our talks with B2B examples, not consumer brands, but B2B examples, or the rule is not intuited from that. And you Correct. Still have to be explicit about the rule anyway.
You 100% have to be explicit about the rule, because that's how you do two things. One, it's how you satisfy the rule-based learners who are just, because if you're not explicit about the rule that you are trying to illustrate, the rule-based learners will extract their own. And that's dangerous. Like if you want to make sure that your idea kind of gets into somebody else's head with as little distortion as possible, the easiest way to make sure you do that is to tell them the idea that you are trying to communicate. Yeah. The second thing is that the research with rule-based and example-based learners shows is that example-based learners can be taught to see the rule, but you have to draw the moral of the story and then kind of give them another example that shows them that rule applied. So it's kind of like a V-shaped model. Like in my head, where you kind of start with an example, draw the rule, show it in another example, mm-hmm. is generally a good overall framework to think about how do you present your information, is making sure that no matter where you start, because it can also be kind of like a upside down V. You can start with the rule, give an example, kind of reiterate the rule, and then give another example. That's really important. But you're right. I mean, you and I both speak to both B2B and B2C audiences, and B2B audiences, for very good reason, are like, well, we're not B2C. And then they get a little frustrated. And even if you say, yeah, but everybody, it's like still like human to human. I was at the B2B, had the great pleasure of speaking at the B2B marketing conference, marketing exchange conference in Scottsdale a couple of weeks ago. And that's like one of that conference's like personal bugaboos, is like, it's all humans.
Oh, don't say that.
Don't say that, because I mean, it is, but the thing is there are differences. And so the thing is, even if you use a B2B example in a B2C audience or vice versa, you still need to say, here's a B2C example. Here's the rule. Here's how it applies to B2B. You can't just say, figure it out.
Figure it out. They're all people.
Because only a quarter of your audience is likely to be able to do that. And it's not a shortcoming. It's just wired differently.
That's a good way, by the way, as an aside here, that if you do use lots of business to consumer examples to a B2B audience, and they challenge you on that, and you say, well, it's all P2P, person to person, people to people, you will be flayed alive at the atomic level, because it's not. That's not how B2B sales work. They happen in committee, and then up to the next committee, and then up to, you know, it's all.
And sales cycles that last forever.
Yes. Yeah. So let's talk about the three main ways that we can use examples. And there are metaphors, there are analogies, and there are stories. And I think this is probably going to be a two-part episode, because story is going to take a little bit more time.
That's probably true. Yeah. And I'd like to, I think of it that metaphors and stories are two ways to use analogies. And I think ultimately it's the analogy that's the most powerful tool for a freenoter and a keynoter. So let's talk about what we mean by each of those.
Sure. Well, let's dispense with metaphor really quickly, because I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on that. We've talked a couple of times on the show about a term or a concept in rhetoric called the known new contract. And it's something that I've lived by for 30 years, which is, if you're going to introduce something new, that you need to begin that expression with something that is known or agreed upon, so that you're not starting in foreign territory. Back in the 90s, I used to consult radio stations, and anytime they were going to play a brand new piece of music that, you know, from a new artist or something that had never been heard before, it was going to be preceded, you know, by Celine Dion and then immediately followed by something else that was familiar, in a way to kind of protect that. And that's how new music gets introduced, kids.
And that's right. And the minute that you as a speaker say, so the Celine Dion of your talk is a known story or a known metaphor, you have just used metaphor, because you have replaced a concept with another concept without any other introduction. You have basically said, hey, your preceding example is Celine Dion. Celine Dion is your example. And you've moved on from there. So it's really a language device. It's a shortcut. It's basically to say, where you're saying, I am talking about one thing and I mean another, and we're just going to use those two. And the thing is, we use metaphor is so central to how humans think that there's some crazy statistics about how many metaphors we use even in like a minute of conversation. It's bananas. Metaphor.
That's a metaphor.
like how crazy it is. And even saying something is crazy is a metaphor. And so it's just the metaphors are so baked into our language that they're important. Where they become powerful, and I think you and I both agree about this, is that when you make the metaphor explicit and you draw the rule from them. And the minute that you draw a rule out of a metaphor or from a story is now when you're using an analogy. So you are so good at using analogies, finding analogies and using them. Why do you feel that they're so powerful, particularly with the kind of information you present?
Well, I want to say one quick last thing about metaphors, about just how they can plug into our language as shortcuts.
Both metaphors.
and it's sort of the homework that you do when you're speaking to, look at you. When you're speaking to a new group of people or people that are in a different field, right? I mean, if I'm going to speak in front of a crowd of ophthalmologists and I need them to see the bigger picture, I'm going to use myopia and things. I'm going to use some of their terminology.
Like seeing the bigger picture.
Right. so if we're talking to pilots about seeing the 50,000 foot view of our business or whatever, but they're just little pieces of language that ease the way.
Yeah.
That ease the way, as the Bene Gesserit would say in Dune, that eases the path.
Okay.
When you're speaking in front of a different crowd and you're trying to get that known new contract with them, use some of their terms as metaphors. That's a great tip. Analogies and stories, not necessarily two different things, because a story serves as an analogy, but there's a difference between a story and an analogy. I think that's just a pure analogy and not a story. And I don't often tell stories. And that's, so I'm just going to talk about how I use analogies. Mm-hmm. I use analogies because the things that I talk about are complex to people. And often what I'm giving people are examples, like data examples. And I need them to intuit the simple rule behind them all. But I can't do that unless they understand my data. You know, I can't just give them four or five data charts and say, and here's the simple rule. I actually have to make the data simpler for them, and then roll all of that up into a simple analogy, right? That this is like this is like this, which is very similar to what you see in life, which is this and this and this.
Yeah.
And you can see the rule behind it. And then I express the rule behind it. But I've learned over the years not to assume that people will see the rule behind it.
So tell us, I mean, one of my favorite examples recently was your use of feral hogs as an analogy.
Yeah.
You got to explain that one, because it was brilliant and people picked it up and they started to use it, which is such a great indicator that the analogy was successful.
Yeah. People snapped it up like hotcakes.
That's a simile.
As if. Yeah. So I gave a keynote at Podcast Movement and there's lots of debates about what is and isn't a podcast, and podcasters kind of maintaining this control over what it is they do, and that their ultimate goal is to get you to subscribe. And we'd love you to subscribe to the Free Noter, by the way, but do or don't, just listen to it. And I wanted to make a sort of a grand point about how that's not relevant today like it was in 2010. And so I showed a picture of a sheep herder with a border collie herding sheep into a pen. And I had labeled it like the sheep was like, you know, the audience, and the border collie was like, subscribe to us on iTunes, and the pen was iTunes. And, you know, it's like, that's how you thought 10 years ago, like I'm going to push everybody into the pen of iTunes so they'll subscribe to me, and that's where I'll have control of them, and I can monetize them there. And I showed that slide, and then I said, but your audience are not sheep. They're feral hogs. They are feral hogs. And I showed this slide of like 30 to 50 feral hogs like running rampage. And I said, they're rummaging through your turnips. They're stumbling onto you on SoundCloud and Spotify, and they're going all willy-nilly. And that landed a point for me. It wasn't a story. No. I wasn't telling, you know, the parable of the feral hog. I wasn't doing that. But I was trying to powerfully land a point, and I think I did it through laughter there, that you are not in control. You never have been. The audience has always been in control. And it was finding that simple sheep and feral hogs. Like, that's it. I was trying to cut to the quick of that example. How can I really simply and powerfully land this point after all this data that I have shown that you are not in control of the audience?
That is the power of example and rule, is that that example can take, and this is the thing, I love story, and we're going to talk about story, and whether or not we talk about it in full bore here, pun not intended. I know. But you can use, the whole point of using analogy is that it doesn't always have to be a story. And I do so much work with people of technical background, scientific background, you know, and I think it's similar to you in the work that you do with data, that sitting up there or standing up there and saying to someone, well, once upon a time, there was this thing that, like, it doesn't suit the mood. It doesn't suit the audience. Yes, story has power, and stories are very, very powerful, but there's also large groups of people that discount the moment that you go into a story because they start to roll their eyes. I'm like, oh, there's this thing again. And so I think, to me, the real key here is an analogy, remembering that the analogy is only powerful when you A, have an example, and B, draw the rule from it. So I'm curious how, like, what, because I get this question actually a fair amount from my clients, which is like, how do you find those metaphors or those stories that you use for analogy? So what's, I mean, I have my approach. I'm curious what yours is.
I don't find them. I collect them. And that is, I think that works for me. I can't give you advice on how to find them, because it's part of my neural network. I collect them.
Yeah.
And any analogy that I give is something that I have directly experienced. It's something I directly worked on. It's a movie I saw. It's a book I read.
You've had direct experience with feral hogs.
I mean, the 90s were a little rough, baby. I had to make ends meet. But I think you collect them. And you know, you do a great job every week on your newsletter of giving people what you call the swipe file.
Yes.
Which is just great example after great example after great example, which you willingly give to people, like take this, right? But
I'm doing the collection anyway, so I figure why not? I mean, I can't possibly use all of that. So, but it's interesting to me, and even as little as 5 years ago, I didn't think I was great at coming up with metaphors, analogies, and stories. And so I set it as an intention, not in like a woo woo way. And I'm like, I want to get better at this. And I don't feel like, I just didn't have enough inputs in order to be able to make those associations. And you were one of the folks that I looked up to with that. And I was like, well, how do you do that? And you just, a lot of it's from your background, but also you're extraordinarily well read, and you've been through a lot.
Seen some things.
And so I was like, well, I want to do that. And so I just started, honestly a daily practice, which you know is true of reading and collecting. And then I realized I had more stuff I could ever possibly use. And thus the swipe file, which in a lot of ways is an analogy engine. My brain holds onto that kind of stuff for whatever reason. And so, usually it takes it takes sometimes as many as like two or three searches to kind of re-find a thing that I know that I've seen before. But I think that, you know, I love your idea that you collect them. I still think there is a process there, though. And what a lot of it depends. And if I'm working with somebody directly on this, it depends on whether or not I can suss out fairly quickly if they're an example learner or rule learner. And by the way, you usually can, because someone who's an example learner will be like, can you give me an example? I mean, literally that's always mm-hmm, true. Mm-hmm. And the rule learners will be like, well, what's the idea? Like that's what they're asking. Either way, so if it's an example learner and they're trying to figure out, okay, well, how do I find other, like, how do I, like, what story should I tell or what metaphor can I use in an analogy? If it's an example learner, the first thing I'll say, well, tell me a story that this reminds you of. Like, so tell me the story. Hmm. And because I'm a rule learner, I can say, well, is this the point that you're trying to make? And when I do that with folks, they can either say, yes, that's the point. Or more often than not, if they don't directly agree with that point, they'll say, well, actually, it's like that, but it's actually this point. And this is a great example of the fact that an example learner can be taught to see the rule. And so once we have that, mm-hmm. See, it all comes down to the rule. Once you know what the rule is, then you can go find other things like that. And that's when you can, and that's what I say to people. Once you turn on your reticular activating system, which is the thing that makes you see things more, like when you, like once you've bought like a white Volkswagen Bug, who has that? You start to see a ton of white Volkswagen Bugs like out on the road.
Yeah. Well, I think there's also, and this is why, honestly, I don't think there's a shortcut. I think you collect them, because I think over time you build up a vocabulary of analogies, just in the same way that, that the Eskimo have 50 words for snow and
apocryphal.
I think that's true. I believe it.
Okay.
It's a metaphor.
In this case, it is. Yeah. Yes.
And look, there are 50 ways you can say evil, right? You can say enormity. You can say heinous. You can say vicious.
Malice.
Right.
This is why I do crossword puzzles, by the way.
This is why, well, same here. I have a vocabulary of analogies and I will pull them out. They all may have the same denotation, you know, the sort of dictionary
moral,
meaning,
yeah.
But they might have different connotations. And I'll give you a really good example of this, right? There's a talk I give where I kind of take apart something that's done in B2B marketing a lot called buyer personas. And I've never been a huge fan of buyer personas, which are basically putting a template shortcut together for the type of buyer for your product, like outsourcing Oliver I don't know, do it yourself Dave or whatever. Like I've never been a huge fan of those. And so when I talk about them, the analogy that I pick is meant to convey that I think they are ridiculous without me ever having to say that they are ridiculous, because I say, essentially, you put together a template, much like the stencils in a Play-Doh Fun Factory, mm-hmm. and you jam some Play-Doh into the pumper, and you extrude these personas through the stencil, and out they come in big star-shaped logs. It's a clear analogy for what I'm talking about, that they all sort of fit one of five types. But I'm making it ridiculous because I think it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's an advanced use of analogy.
Yes.
It's a kind of a paradoxical thinking where you're taking something to its illogical extreme in order for somebody to back off of their current position. I think that I agree that you collect, but I think you can either have a store of collection or you can start. And that's the thing. I know, as a person who spent most of my life thinking that I was not a great storyteller, that I didn't have all these examples that I could pull. And I don't say this with any, I say this with all humility now. I think people think of me as a person who can come up with analogies and metaphors and connect. It really happened in the last 5 years because I set it as a point that I wanted to be able to do this better.
I can only now understand you.
But I mean, I think that, but I've seen it happen with my clients as well. When I say, this is the point that we're looking for, or this is, you know, so either this is the point that we're looking for, look for other stories, look for other examples of things that are like that, or, hey, you told me it was like this story. Tell me about other things. Look for other times when you see a similar story happening. And so I think you don't have to have a huge cache of them already in hand. It's useful, but the thing is that there are certain people who who you look at and you're like, how did all those things happen to you? Like, these just me, but they're the people who I think for whatever reason, they held on to those stories in their mind. But I think you can start from, you know, whether it's a story or a metaphor, you know, it's the analogy that's powerful when you come to being a freenoter or a keynoter, because the real power of that is not even just example versus rule. It's borrowing what people already know.
Bingo.
And it's back to what you were talking about, the known new contract, which is, but you can make a very complicated thing much simpler, because you don't have to explain all the technical ins and outs. If you can say, it's like this.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be perfect. And this is the thing that I run into a lot, again, because of my work with scientists and engineers, and that they want to be accurate. And so a lot of my work is trying to figure out how to create an accurate analogy that allows for the nuance to come. So we'll start by saying, okay, but for right now, can we say that the closest thing that this is like layaway at the store? And they're like, yes. And I'm like, great, don't worry. We're going to say it's like layaway, except, and that's where you can start to modify it. But the closer you can come to something where you can say, this is like that, whether it's a quick, simple, to the point metaphor, which is helpful if you've got an audience that is, that it tends to be technically or data minded and they don't want to sit through a story, no matter, this is a great, one of those places where like, well, people are people and they love stories. I'm like, not if they've decided they don't.
No. And then there's context. In that context, right, they may not want to hear a story.
And that's where a metaphor can be super helpful, because you can get a lot of the same benefit of that. Kendall Haven, the author who wrote Story Smart and Story Proof, great books, by the way. He talks about this banks of prior knowledge, and he uses a metaphor, you know, as an analogy of saying, hey, you know, all the things that we know, we keep in like file folders and file cabinets in our heads. And when somebody is analyzing a new piece of information, they're going and checking the file cabinet and they're going, do I know something? Does that connect to something that I already know? Is that like something I already know? And the minute that you can point someone and actually say, go look here in your file cabinet, this is like that, you save yourself an extraordinary amount of time, effort, and cognitive load in your audience by being able to say, hey, it's like this. So I honestly think even before learning to be a great storyteller, one of the great skills that any presenter should learn is collecting metaphors, is collecting stories, is collecting the things that could be analogies.
Yeah. And you know, you're right. I mean, I do collect them, but in fairness, I do seek them out sometimes. And I think when you seek them out, it is again as part of a shortcut, and that's part of the research that you do on your audience. And if I'm doing it, you know, I've given talks for the digital team at Frito-Lay, and I've given talks for the digital team at the Purina, the pet food division of Purina, right?
Yep.
And if I'm going to give an analogy about a concept I'm trying to make, and I'm talking to Purina, I'm not going to say, well, you know, it's like Josh Brolin's character in The Goonies. A couple people will chuckle at that, right? But what I really want to find out is like, what's the difference between Blue Ribbon and Yukonuba, and how can I pull an analogy from that? Because that's their vocabulary.
Right.
So it's pulling out an analogy. When I do seek them, it's to speak the same language.
And ultimately, all of this idea of analogy and banks of prior knowledge, it's why stories are so powerful. And this was something that, again, I learned from Kendall Haven, which is that because stories are how we make sense of information, and that happens pre-consciously, that we're always turning the information that we have into stories. Essentially what we're doing when we're checking new information, we're checking like, what other story is this like? Like, tell me what else I've seen. But what's so fascinating about stories, and about story structure in particular, is that the story structure itself can provide enough context for it to feel familiar to people. And so this is why, in addition to metaphors, when you have enough time, when you have an audience that is really open to it, and when you have when contextually a story can work, it's one of the reasons why stories are so powerful, because A, it's how we make sense of information, but because the very format is familiar to people. It's a way to kind of preload context, because people expect information, the certain kinds of information to happen in a certain order in a story. And that's one of the reasons why they're just like gold.
So we're going to spend the next episode fully on story and the structure of story, because it's such a deep topic that it deserves a deeper look. But I don't want this podcast to end without kind of quickly going over what's the difference between an analogy and a story. And a story can be used as an analogy.
Yep.
100%. But what are the unique elements of a story that make it stand apart? Not every analogy is a story.
Right. Yes, that's true. Because as we said, because a metaphor can be an analogy. An analogy is any time that you take, two things and you say, this is like that, and you're making the case that one is like the other in order to drive home like your rule, your basic truth, your simple truth. To me, there's a lot of different ways to define story. Sometimes people say a story is a beginning, middle, and end. And to paraphrase my colleague Nick Morgan, who was paraphrasing a friend of his, a piece of thread also has a beginning, middle, and end, so that's less useful. But I think one of the big things that one of my favorite definitions of story is from friend, colleague, storytelling expert Ron Plouffe, who says that a story is the result of people pursuing what they want. And I love that because, it's super, super simple. It includes the basic elements of story, which is there are people who want something, they are pursuing it, and it's what happens as a result. It implies the central difference between a story and an anecdote, which is the presence of conflict, right? An anecdote is, hey, I almost met Joni Mitchell once. And conflict is, whole setting up about how, meeting Joni Mitchell would have meant like failing the thing that you had spent your entire life studying for, or that kind of thing. But to me, there's elements of story. That's the core of the red thread, which is the method that I've developed is trying to figure out what are those elements of the universal story that provides context. But I think if we were really talking about the components of story, one of the people we should talk about is perhaps
Kendra Hall.
Kendra Hall.
Yeah. Kendra Hall. Kendra Hall is a fantastic storyteller. What a speaker she is.
Oh, she's so great.
She's really, really great.
And she's a client. And yours too. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually it is in fact, her kind of elements of a story that brought us together. So I do research and she came to me with a theory, with a hypothesis on what some of the elements of a great story might be. There's one thing to say that a story has a conflict, or a story is an argument is another one that I've heard.
Yeah. Robert McKee says that.
But are there great elements that a great story has to have in order for it to be very, very effective? And, Kendra actually did the work with us. We designed a study to look at, a variety of elements that we switched out in all of this, just many, many, many permutations of models. She's got a great book, which I will link in the show notes. But to her... Stories that stick, yeah. To her, the elements... The best story you can give has all four of these elements. It has an identifiable character, and that's something you can customize to your audience, or maybe it's something that your audience is familiar with. But it does have to have the character he or she or it has to have some kind of. Yeah. So I was thinking it like a cat or a dog, but yes, or they does have to have a hook you can grab onto. So an identifiable character, some kind of authentic emotion. Has to be a part of that, a particular moment. So you can't just sort of generalize like you do this all the time, but there was this moment. And then a specific detail. It could be a specific place. It could be something in particular that someone in the story is doing. But a lot of that, I think, is just kind of good common sense, and she quantified it, that people like specifics. They like handles for the attaché that you're asking them to carry.
Yeah.
And, it's almost like, how a virus. This show is brought to you by coronavirus.
Hmm.
Yeah. But a virus is like a key to a lock. And in a sense, the way that Kendra constructs a story is to have very particular locks.
Mm. Yep.
Very specific details, because it actually makes it easier to latch onto and for those stories to spread.
Well, and for all the reasons that we already talk about, the more specifics that are in a story, the more emotional it is, the easier it is for you to riffle through your banks of prior knowledge and go, oh, that's like this other thing. Oh, I have felt that before. Oh, that's like this. Which is, you know, when you keep something general, it's much harder to say, to kind of put your finger on that file folder and be like, this is the one. And so that inclusion of specifics, and I love how she does it, that she's like, it's a specific character, it's a specific moment, it's a specific emotion, and then there are specific details of time and place. Those are all things that help people identify more clearly and cleanly with that story. But the reason why it's so powerful, because it allows them to attach it and make their own analogy in their head with, like, oh, it's like this.
Yeah, and that sort of brings us to, you know, we watched Casino Royale again.
We did.
Last night, which I have to tell you is my favorite James Bond movie. Not the David Niven one, but the Daniel Craig one is actually my favorite James Bond movie.
I'm a Skyfall girl personally, but it was fun to see it again. And I remember when Casino Royale first came out. Well, even when you brought it up, I'm like, I want to see that again. And thus we watched it last night.
And so we did. And James Bond actually invents a drink on the fly, and it's part of a story. And I think it's part of a story that he is telling to the other people around the playing table that he's at, that he's a particular eccentric, basically, and not just some, orphaned soccer player, which at some point in his life he was, or footy, we'll say, to our British listeners. And so he invents a drink on the fly, and he calls it the Vesper after his love interest by the end of the movie. And it is, in fact, a drink that Ian Fleming had at Duke's in London. Ian Fleming, who wrote all the 007 novels, had many a Vesper at Duke's in London. Still my favorite martini in all of the world over. But here's the drink, and James invented it on the fly, we think. And it's, as he calls it, it's 3 measures of Gordon's, which is gin, 1 measure of vodka, unspecified, and then a 1/2 measure of Quina Lillet, as he calls it, which is a... now we have Lillet Blanc, which is an aperitif. Quina Lillet, you really can't buy anymore. It was an aperitif that had quinine in it, like tonic water. But it's 3 parts gin, one parts vodka,
yep,
and 1/2 part of Lillet Blanc you can use. So to sort of turn that into ounces, 2 1/4 ounces of gin, 3/4 of an ounce of vodka, and put in 1/2 ounce of Lillet. And you stir that over ice. You strain that into a martini glass. Put a twist of lemon on it. And in James Bond's words, that's not bad.
And it's a lovely well-balanced martini. So for folks that don't think they like gin or don't think they like martinis, it really isn't that. I mean, it is the Gordon's or any kind of London, good London dry. Of course, the favorite gin here at the Freenoter is Plymouth gin.
Plymouth is the house. Yep.
Plymouth, because it doesn't have any strong juniper notes or strong cucumber notes. Hendrick's has a really strong cucumber note to it. But a kind of neutral spirit like that, and then you add to it a neutral spirit like vodka, just rounds it out. The Lillet just kind of gives it a softness, which is lovely. And Sterling Jackson, whom we've mentioned before, the female barman. That's a
female barman.
Totally inside joke. She actually garnishes it with an orange twist, which is lovely. And she hands down makes the best Vesper.
100%.
Anywhere outside of Duke's.
100%. And to round out the Casino Royale story here, of course, while he's sitting in a tailored tuxedo ordering this, making this drink up on the fly to look like he's genteel, later after he gets poisoned and beaten up, he shows back up at the bar, very bedraggled, and just asks for a vodka martini. And the bartender asks, shaken or stirred? And to introduce us all to Daniel Craig, he said, "Do I look like I care?"
So good. So good.
So good. You know what else is so good?
What else is so good?
Doing this show with you, my love.
I have such fun.
I think it's time to wrap this one up.
All right, let's wrap it up.
Let's wrap it up. So okay. On next week's episode of The Freenoter, we're going to continue our exploration of story. We're going to dive deeper into story structure, how Kurt Vonnegut looks at story, how some other performers look at story. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
We'll continue our exploration of what makes a great story by looking at the work specifically of our great friend, Nick Morgan.
And we're going to try an absolutely terrible cocktail just so you can hear us choke on it.
All that and more on next week's episode of The Freenoter.
Cheers.
Cheers.